It's Poetry Month. No time to quibble. Let's scribble.
To Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Our guest today is Dale Hockey, who is both a lawyer and a poet. Then it's on to Garrison Keillor and Writer's Almanac on Scribble. And first off, I think we would like to ask our guest, Dale, to read a poem.
Well, thank you, Don, and thank you, Roald and Don, for inviting me here. I greatly appreciate it. This is a request of Dr. Tweet, and it's a poem that I wrote in 2002. It's dedicated to my father, Earl D. Hockey, 1915 to 1995. Pacific Theater, World War II, and if I recall, it says in his discharge papers, Eastern Mandates, which meant he, I think, flew over Japan. Echoes of Iwo Jima. Every day now, they fall. Among the 10 lines describing a man's entire life, the Rotary here, the Little League there, a VP, a union steward. They're falling now, some days even more than during great battles. The ones that didn't fall in 42 or 3 or 4. Among those 10 lines, almost as an afterthought, I say, by the way, he stormed the beach at Omaha or Anzio or Iwo Jima, Saipan, or Guam. The sounds come back now, distant, scratchy, big band songs, unbraced teeth smiling through the photos, whose graininess is almost heard through the fading echoes of 78s. We lose them day by day by day.
That's very impressive. That's a wonderful tribute to the fallen soldiers.
Yeah, I tend to, both of you guys probably know this from some of my I tend to get very sentimental about the greatest generation. You know, my generation, oh, yeah, I'm proud of this and that, but it's like, oh, geez, what did we do? But the greatest generation, I mean, there's a lot of things to criticize, but when you think of what these people did, and, I mean, when I was growing up in Wakanda, you'd go to the Memorial Day parade, and there'd be the World War I soldiers sitting in the park by the Federated Church. And the World War II guys were the guys walking around with kids on their backs with their hats and their bowling shirts and, whatever. And they felt Memorial Day wasn't for them. They were just, living their life. And it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, sooner or later, we are all our memorials, usually short ones.
Right.
That's the amazing thing about death. I've had close friends die, and it's just amazing. They are erased. They survive only in your memory, and then when you're gone, they're gone.
Now, dear listeners, we do plan on brightening this up later in the show.
Right.
Just in case you were about to...
Yeah. Well, you've got some funny stuff, too. But let's talk a little bit in general terms. And I'm not being snarky when I ask, what makes what you just read a poem rather than chopped up prose? You know, when I grew up, if it rhymed, it was a poem, right? Or
right.
At least it was verse. But you write, as does almost everyone else today, in free verse. How can you tell whether it's a poem or not?
Yeah, I think, that's one of those questions that I can talk all around, and you can look at me like, do you really believe exactly what you're saying? I have very few... rhyming poems, and I actually am going to start writing a little bit more in form, but 98% of what I produce for the public would be in free verse, that's clear.
But clearly, partly in the way you read it, but also the way it's written. It's a poem, right? I don't have any doubt about that.
Well, I do appreciate that. I guess one of the things that I look at is if I were to, and this is one that I wrote a long time ago, and I don't really have any changes to it, but you know, there's a word "the" in there. I usually eliminate the word "the" from my poems. It's kind of a prosaic word. Doesn't seem to convey too much in the small space you have someone's attention. But I think it touches the idea, and I think we kind of figure it out pretty quickly without me having to explain it in this particular poem, that especially with the title, Echoes of Iwo Jima. You know, what are the echoes? Well, guys that came back lived their full lives and are dying every day in vets' hospitals, you know, some with family all around them, some rich on their yachts, and others poor and practically homeless. And so and the number that we lose of these vets all the time now, it's every day it's like a great battle.
One of the things that makes it a poem is when you talk about the grainy photographs and take the crackle of 78 RPM records and align that with that. That is poetic.
Well,
that is unquestionably poetic.
Why?
Because it brings together two disparate things on common ground. And the thing about poetry, I admire, is that you read it and you're not just reading what's there, but you're reading everything that what's there evokes. And sometimes it's more than you can take in all at once.
Yeah, Jacob Bronowski calls a creative act the act of fusion, of bringing together two disparate things.
And then when you read poetry, it's like setting off a hand grenade. It all explodes.
Yeah.
But
so
why?
It's partly the images, but also it's the way you read it, the rhythm of the poem, mm-hmm. right? I mean,
and I'm glad you said rhythm because many of my friends have heard the story, but several years ago when I was the Quad Cities Poet Laureate, I got asked to judge a poetry contest, and I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I'm not an academic who has all these credentials. And my best friend, he goes, what kind of a BS cop-out is that? That's your shtick. If you're going to take the
right.
crown, you better get the laurel. You better get, and I, mm-hmm. You're right. Oh, what am I talking about? So I accepted, but then I thought, I'm the one who's going to judge these people's poetry? And on what basis do I have any objective thoughts about it? So I did create some, and it's kind of broken into three parts. And the very first part is there better be a song. There better be a melody. There better be a stream. Otherwise, it's not a poem, no matter yeah. what. And so this probably went through, it doesn't usually says on what draft this is. This may have been a first draft, which would be unusual, but it might be a second or a third draft. Normally there's a Roman numeral down there that would tell me, but there are probably some things that could be improved to make it more song-like. So I think that the rhythm, there is a rhythm there. It doesn't always go maybe the way you want, but there is a rhythm there. And so I think that's kind of a signal.
But probably shouldn't go the way you want, right?
I think that if it's going to really be, if it's going to really be something worthwhile in some ways, I think at some point in time the poet loses track of it in the sense that, I mean, this has been out, this has been in the Quad City Times, this is Mark, et cetera, et cetera. And so, like Donald Hall that one time came back to the Quad Cities, and I think he was at Rebecca Wee's trying to change in pencil the words of a book that he took out of her bookshelf of his poems. Because So, yeah, there comes a point where, you want to change it, but you have to say, well, you know, I don't, it's mine, but I don't have the right to really do much more with it anymore.
I just heard a great interview on NPR with Jane Hirschfield a couple of weeks ago. She's a contemporary poet, one of my favorite current poets. And she said, a poem has a kind of intelligence the poet lacks. Right? So you shouldn't make it more rhythmic, right? It's its own thing.
You know, Richard Wagner's great comment on writing The Ring He wrote the words and the music. And he observed, it's changing under my hand. This is not quite what I intended.
Right.
And it took off in a different way and became perhaps the greatest artistic creation of the century, because it was prophetic and lyrical. It had everything. But he did not expect it to become what it became.
Yeah. And I think in good poetry that, you know, I think if you're going to sit down and write verse, right, mm-hmm. 30 days has September, April, June, and November, you're in control of that. But I think in a good poem, right, you aren't exactly in control.
I never feel in control. And I had a poetry workshop at Midwest Writing Center Saturday, and one of the people in my workshop was he's a very good local poet, Joe Chambers. And so we talked about various things, and we threw out some interesting prompts. And one of the things I didn't throw out was about the beautiful buildings of the factories of Davenport that are now being cleaned up, and people are living
there. You're away from
the mic. Oh, sorry. the downtown Davenport, pretty. And when we went around and asked if people wanted to read what they had created from these various prompts, Joe had said, well, it started out like this, but as usual, you know, I didn't really have that much of control of where it went. And I feel the same way. I knew I had certain things that I wanted to portray, and I knew, because I have a record somewhere where my father sent back from Guam on a small 78, and we heard it 40 years ago, 50 years ago at home, scratchy, 1944, sent back to my mom, who could play it on her 78. We still have that somewhere. But I have a bunch of their 78s. The graininess, the unbraced teeth, the big band. Dave Barry wrote something recently. Someone gave me something about Lincoln, but Dave Barry was on the back. And he was talking about that generation. Yeah, they were the greatest generation, but they also had fun. And he explained why our generation is just too uptight to have fun. It was quite interesting.
Well, let's have another poem.
All right. Now, those of you who are, I was thinking of reading an anti-war poem called The Flowers, but it's in German, called Die Blumen. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, it is in English, isn't it?
Yes. There are a couple of German words, though, so I'll prompt those, if you don't mind. Mann, M-A-N-N, is either man or husband. Kirsch is the...
Cherry.
The only cherry liqueur that is not sweet. Kursk is the great tank battle, but also the submarine that went down like 10 years ago. Die Blumen is the flowers. Leutnant is lieutenant. Blankenese is a rich city by Hamburg, and everyone knows Kristallnacht.
Okay.
Now, I met with my wife's dear friend's parents. The father was a German infantry soldier. He was 91 when I met him. It was amazing. And this is not after them, but it was inspired by meeting them, because this is about a guy who dies before the war. It's called The Flowers, but of course it's in German, Die Blumen. And the old German woman with the black apron and wide feet, widowed in 39, her man never tasting the sweetness of victory over France, nor the bittersweet Kirsch of Kursk. Tending die Blumen, ever die Blumen, geraniums and roses, scarlet in defiance of the gray Hamburg skies. Blankly passing der Leutnant's fading photo on her Blankenese mantle, avoiding the thorns, torn lives, two sides of the veil, only partly hiding the what was from the what could have been. Azure eyes now buried among the wrinkles. Buried memories of youth gone awry, of youth left to rot in shallow graves. Her neighbor's shop smashed in Kristallnacht. She looked away, her long interred shame fleeting across her consciousness. Barely. A thorn digs its neutral point into her aged thumb, and the drops of blood spatter die Blumen, mix with the crimson petals disappearing beneath the gunmetal Hamburg skies.
No.
That leads to another question.
who are you writing your poems for? You, or do you have an imagined reader? Or if somebody wants to read them and get something out of it, fine, but that's not it, or what?
Definitely first for me.
Well, you already know it. Why do you have to write for you?
I don't know it.
Okay.
We discussed that 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. Okay.
So I didn't know where this was going to go. And in fact, it turned out to go from immediately. It went from this happy couple in 2003 or 1996, I guess, when I first met them. And then when I went back, he had passed away. But, you know, to a World War II widow and the guy, you know, dying even before the victory over France. And so, yeah, who do I write it for? I'm not sure. Yes, I want it to be as ultimately as entertaining, as thought-provoking, as provocative as possible for the listener or the reader, yes. So, you know, anytime I think that I can try and improve something like that, I work on it to do so.
I may have an answer for you. When I give talks, I never prepare them because I don't really know what I think until I hear myself say it. And it may be you don't really know what you think until you put it in writing.
Well, and that echoes, so to speak, what we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. And in when I go over into being, I mean, most of my life I'm a lawyer, and less of my life I'm a poet, but I have to go to court prepared. I have to make arguments prepared. I have to stand up to, you know, question a witness prepared, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are times, though, where emotion and passion and, you know, I think assists or heightens your ability to think about that and the creativity and passion that goes with it. So there are times when, yes, I'm prepared, but, you know, I'm no robot.
Mm-hmm.
And any time you know you can prepare so much so that you're competent, but after that it's what you put into that. Mm-hmm. So,
well,
I'm not sure I answered that your question.
Well, that's about all the time we have for an answer, so it's going to have to serve.
Okay.
But Dale Hockey, poet and lawyer, thank you very much. You're the first of three lawyers we're going to be talking to who also happen to be poets. I don't get the connection, but we will explore it later on.
All right.
Dale Hockey has been our guest today on National Poetry Month. We'll continue now with another fellow who is very interested in all forms of writing and guarantees us a poem, and that, of course, is Garrison Keillor.